This is The Record on KUOW. I'm Ross Reynolds. Cesar Chavez was the most influential Latino civil rights leader in American history. He organized powerless farm workers into a powerful force. He organized a national movement to boycott agricultural products on their behalf. Miriam Powell has written a new biography called The Crusades of Cesar Chavez. Miriam is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and editor. She's worked at Newsday and the Los Angeles Times. A great pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Maybe set the context for us. Take us back to the 1960s when Cesar Chavez began his work. What was life like for farm workers?
To be a farm worker was to be in a situation where you were sort of utterly powerless and subject to your employer. And it was a both brutally, physically challenging work and backbreaking work. And then also there was a sort of real sense of a loss of dignity, and there was a lack of respect for workers, and they were treated in many ways as sort of nothing more than farm implements and considered as replaceable as tractors. So you had a group of people who were subject to lots of real serious physical hardship, had no recourse under the kinds of laws that most other workers would have, at least, you know, legal grounds to stand on. And there were always more workers than there were jobs. So it was sort of easy to say, if you don't like the conditions, you know, someone else will take the job.
And now many of them were undocumented also, right? So that
many of them
led to their having even less power. There was no authority they could even go to if they wanted to.
That's right. And they're not as many as are undocumented today, where in California, for example, you know, the overwhelming percentage are. But many were recent immigrants. Many were, I mean, Cesar Chavez was not an immigrant. He was born in Arizona. So remember that, I mean, he comes to Arizona, comes from Arizona to California when he's 12 years old, becomes a migrant worker, and his family becomes migrant farm workers because they lose their farm in Arizona in the Depression to tax foreclosure. And he comes to California within a month of the publication of The Grapes of Wrath. So, you know, if you think for people who've read The Grapes of Wrath and remember what the Jode family, what life was like for the Jode family, that's a very much what it was like to be a farm worker at that point in time.
How did he come to lead farm workers in improving their lives? How did he get there?
Well, so from his own experience, he had a sense of the loss of dignity, the loss of respect, and the sort of backbreaking nature of the work as a kid. And it's interesting because he didn't spring full born just as a farm worker organizer in 1965 when people began to sort of hear about him. He had a 10-year apprenticeship as a community organizer, really. He had worked his way out of the fields. He was working in 1952 in a lumber yard in San Jose, you know, a significant step up from field work. When a man named Fred Ross, who no one's, not very many people these days, unfortunately, have heard of Cesar Chavez, but even fewer people have heard of Fred Ross, who was sort of a legendary figure within the world of community organizing and established a group called the Community Service Organization, which was really the first grassroots civil rights group for Mexican Americans in California. And Fred Ross comes to San Jose in 1952 and is holding house meetings, which were little meetings in people's houses, to just kind of explain what the CSO did. The CSO was very mainstream in many ways at that point in time, in the sense that it was supported by the Daughters of the American Revolution, among other groups, because they were helping to Mexican Americans to assimilate. They were doing voter registration. They were doing English classes, citizenship classes. And while there is some wariness about empowering Mexican Americans, the idea of sort of bringing them into the mainstream was in many ways socially acceptable. So Fred Ross comes to San Jose and meets Cesar Chavez when he is a 25-year-old lumber handler. And they immediately, I mean, Ross sees in Chavez the potential of a very smart guy who grasps right away the potential of the power of community organizing. And for Chavez, it's a way out of this sort of life of being always a second-class citizen. And he immediately kind of embraces the idea of organizing.
You know, when you see clips of Cesar Chavez, he doesn't look spellbinding in particular. How did he win the allegiance of these powerless workers? How did he draw them to the cause?
So that ties a little bit to this 10-year period where he becomes an apprentice to Fred Ross in some sense and really learns to organize one by one. And he kept diaries and reports and activity reports and letters from that period of time. And in reading them, you kind of see his evolution and how he learns to organize. And he was sort of... he was a charismatic figure in a very untypical way, in the sense that, as you said, he's not a commanding presence. He was not a good speaker. He didn't like public speaking. And he yet was able to be very sort of powerful one-on-one. When you talk to people who worked for him, it would be like, and then Caesar looked at me and asked me to do this, and I did. And his power and his strength later on especially come from his actions as opposed to his words. So he was so focused and single-mindedly committed, and people pick up on that. And then, you know, later on with his more public acts of penance in some ways, like his fasts and the marches and so on, he just, you know, his life and his commitment to this cause was a very powerful statement.
Miriam Powell is my guest, and we're talking about her new biography, The Crusades of Cesar Chavez, the great Latino labor leader who died in 1993. I think of him as some kind of an equivalent in that struggle to Martin Luther King Jr. I mean, that's the way he's been regarded in culture. Was success for him long in coming with this national movement that he eventually created?
You know, I guess it depends on how you measure success in some ways. So, you know, when back to in his early organizing days, for him, success was helping one person one-on-one. He set up what he called problem clinics. And sometimes when you read his writings, it's as if he would, you know, the sense of satisfaction in even helping one person figure out how to become a citizen or how to fight an unfair police brutality case or something like that. Those were successes too on a small scale, but then he becomes aware of the potential of really affecting the livelihoods of a whole class of people that were farm workers, and those were people that was his own background, and he had an identification with that. So he sets out to do this sort of very brave and heroic thing. I mean, he walks away in 1962 from a well-paying job to try to do something that's never been done, which is to set up a union for farm workers. And success then again takes sort of many forms. I mean, I think the fact that in April of 1962, he moves to Delano, California with $1,200 in savings and lives on unemployment and his wife's earnings from her work in the fields, and goes around to these small agricultural towns throughout the Central Valley of California, organizing small committees and setting up the Farm Workers Association, which was the first form that the UFW took. And by the end of September, he calls a convention and has about 150 people who come, and they, you know, vote to adopt the Black Eagle that is now, you know, omnipresent, becomes the symbol of the organization, and they adopt Viva la Causa as their motto and agree to assess the members' dues of $350 a month. So, you know, it's kind of remarkable that between April and September he was able to achieve that much.
He had a cause. He had organizing skills in bringing people together. Did he have sort of a grand vision that was always part of what he was trying to convey to the farm workers and to others to get them to align themselves with?
I think he had a vision. The consistent vision that he has, and this creates some problems later on in terms of the history of the union, is of empowering poor people to be able to live in, you know, with a sense of their own dignity and respect, and to be comfortable and not to be living in poverty. And yet part of his vision is also that once you are empowered, you should not forget where you came from. You should not embrace middle class values, and you should continue to sort of help the cause in whatever form. And so it's a complicated vision in some way. And it's not the vision of a labor leader.
Hmm. It must be said that part of Cesar Chavez's success is that he was able to make what he was doing with these powerless farm workers into a huge national movement, right, and get all kinds of people, celebrities, all kinds of people aligned to the cause. Living in that time, everybody knew who Cesar Chavez was.
Right.
How was he able to kind of tap into the greater republic and bring all that to it?
So there he has a tremendous strategic vision. I mean, he was a brilliant tactician and a strategist. And he understands from the beginning that you cannot win the battle in the fields of California, where agribusiness controls not only the jobs, but the state, the city councils and the police force and the courts and everything else. And so he knew from the start that he had to form those kinds of alliances with the world outside and bring that power to bear, the power of religious leaders, the power of the church, eventually the Catholic Church, which embraced his cause as well. And it's the, during the, we're coming out of the period of the civil rights movement. So there's a lot of sort of, there's a lot of infrastructure there that he's able to tap into early on. And then later on, as he becomes, you know, a celebrity in his own right, really, and as the boycott, which we can talk about in more detail, but the boycott is what really sort of, you know, draws in people across the country, because by doing these, this one simple thing of not buying grapes, you can be helping farm workers in California.
And this is something that was a huge issue at the time, boycott grapes. And he was able to get so many people across the country to do that, which really gave him the muscle to get what he wanted to get from those growers.
And University of Washington was a key place for that as well. I mean, there's a lot of stories, and there's some great historical material about the fight to ban grapes from the dining halls in the university. I mean, not just here, but the University of Washington was one of the real hubs. And there was also, and I write about this a little bit in the book, there was a sort of a new generation of Chicano leadership. There was a period when Chicano students were enrolling in larger numbers for the first time. And this become the cause becomes a real organizing tool for them as well.
The latter part of the book, The Crusades of Cesar Chavez, the story takes a turn in his life, and we don't remember him quite like Martin Luther King because of the last chapter of his life, and that kind of gets to his strengths and his weaknesses as a leader. What were the weaknesses that kind of bring down his legacy a little bit?
Well, I mean, he struggles, and there are tape-recorded discussions of this, and you can just kind of hear the agony in some level that in some ways he's a victim of his own success, because he doesn't really want to be running a labor organization. He wants to be running a movement, and he's always said from the beginning that there has to be some cross between a movement and a union. And ultimately, as the union succeeds and has hundreds of contracts and tens of thousands of members, it creates a whole bureaucracy and something that has to be run and has to be administrated. And he views that as what he calls non-missionary work. And it becomes this sort of struggle to how do you keep that going and go on to develop what is a more amorphous idea for him of a poor people's union. So you get a sort of internal war between what direction the movement and the union should take, and ultimately that dooms the union.
He wasn't quite able to make that leap to creating the larger movement he wanted to. There were fewer labor contracts. Even as a union, it was less successful. And perhaps most difficult is that many of his followers said he had become a dictator. What did he do?
His personality, I think, is pretty consistent from the start. He wanted to have control, and he created this movement, and he created the union, and he was not going to let anybody else decide the direction. And I mean, he believed that democracy had its limits, and I think he learns that early on. And going back again to the community service organization, his experience there is that when he's empowering these people and they become middle class, and suddenly they're not that interested in what he thinks they should be. So he's very determined not to be in that position again when he takes, when he creates the Farm Workers Union. He also was, you know, he was ruthless in some ways, as I think most great leaders probably are. He said, there's a quote from him where he says, it's not the nice guy who changes the world, it's the hard-headed guy. Mm-hmm. And he also talked about how he didn't have friends, because if you have friends, then your decisions are influenced by your friendships. So he was, I think, fairly consistently not particularly democratic in how he ran the union, but as long as they were in a fighting mode, that gets masked to a large degree.
Yeah. And not very good just at running the organization. As time went on, some of the same newspapers that lauded him for all of his work on behalf of farm workers were doing exposés about how the farm workers got hundreds of thousands of dollars of grants for health clinics that didn't exist, and hundreds of thousands of dollars for computer systems that didn't exist. There was even implication of fraud in the later years.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was never anything that came out other than sort of very sloppy management, because nobody there really knew how to manage those kinds of grants or money. And they had always sort of taken pride in flaunting authority and flaunting the law to some degree. It's sort of, we're going to operate, as he called it, the nonviolent Viet Cong. And that's the role he was comfortable in. And then, I mean, the world changed. The 80s were not the 60s. So there was not the reservoir of young people willing to just, you know, put their lives on hold and show up to support the cause and work for free for an indefinite period of time. And things changed in the fields and expectations changed. And yet his reputation, and some to some degree in the later years in the 80s and the 90s, kind of grew in proportion to your distance from the field. Hmm. So where the union became less and less important to farm workers, he sort of became the symbol of the Chicano movement and became in, you know, tremendous demand as a speaker around the country.
And he is still regarded as a secular hero. Your book points him out, warts and all. What kind of reactions have you gotten from those who still regard him as above it all?
It's really interesting because, you know, he died 21 years ago this week, actually. He died on April 23rd, 1993. And there has been no biography written until now, which is sort of astonishing. And I think the reason for that is that he's a very complicated guy, and he had not been portrayed that way. And his heirs in particular had taken a lot of steps to sort of paint him in a very extremely favorable and rather simplistic light. And I think the hagiography did him no service because, you know, you get outside of California, the Northwest and the Southwest a little bit, people do not know who he is. Mm. And people below a certain age, even in California, they know there's streets named after this guy, but and farm workers think you're talking about the Mexican boxer. So I think that it's the lack of scholarship until recently, to some degree, that has been responsible for the fact that people don't know who he is. Because what I'm finding in response to this, so because there was a fear on the part of people who knew how complicated he was and how interesting he was, nobody wanted to go near it because for fear of tarnishing the legacy of someone who is the preeminent Latino hero. And I didn't want to do that either. So, but the reason I wrote the book is because I sort of ultimately became convinced that the book is a step towards restoring him to the place in history that he actually deserves. And probably what's been most gratifying to me is that I found that audiences understand that. I mean, you know, and Latinos understand it too. And sometimes it's hard for people who grew up with an idea of who he was to accept that he was more complicated than that and that he had flaws as well. But if you say to people, you know, heroes are human beings and heroes have strengths and weaknesses and they have succeed and they fail, people generally get that.
I want to conclude where we began. The way that farm workers live today in 2014 compared to the way they lived before Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers, has it improved tremendously?
It's improved. It depends on where and how. In real wages, the wages for farm workers in California compared to where they were at the height of the union's power are not any better in most places. And in many cases, they're worse because the union, even where it didn't always have contracts, you know, raised their wages in order to keep the union out. So it had an impact that went far beyond the places that it had contracts. The housing conditions are horrible. The fact that so many farm workers are undocumented now puts them, you know, in a greater sort of risk. And part of the goal of the union, and one thing it achieved during a brief period of time, was to get rid of the labor contractors, who are the middlemen who hire the workers. And labor contractors are back in full force. I mean, it gives the growers a sort of cushion. They don't have to be the ones to know whether their workers are documented or undocumented. And that creates sort of a whole nother set of another area for potential exploitation. So there are better laws on the books today in many places than there were. But you have states like New York, which has fought for years over in an attempt to just get a basic farm worker bill of rights that would give them overtime and one day off a week, and still has not passed. So conditions are not all that much better.
Miriam Powell, it's been a terrific conversation. Thank you so much for coming by. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Her biography is called The Crusades of Cesar Chavez, the great Latino labor leader who died back in 1993. You're listening to The Record.